Well, as I mentioned, we're walking through the Sermon on the Mount, and we started off at the very beginning with the Beatitudes, and what a great call that is to our life, and then dove right into our influence in the world of being salt and light, and we heard the charge of the gospel to impact our community with the hope and joy that we have in our hearts to be the person of Jesus. And then last week, we dove into a whole new subject, really, where he starts talking about true righteousness and what the truly righteous life looks like. Now, obviously, this is the longest recorded message of Jesus in the Bible, and one part builds upon the other. And as he began to lay it out, it was, in one way, it's bad news, because what Jesus calls us to in true righteousness is a life that we cannot gain on our own. And so we get it, this bad news challenge is this righteousness that Jesus speaks of is not possible for man to attain on his own, but we have it provided for us in the person of Jesus Christ. And so he really lets us know that this is not about external law keeping when he talks about this truly righteous life. This is about an internal change, coming to know Christ as your personal Lord and Savior, and the great exchange. He takes our sin, we take his righteousness, and we experience the life that comes in knowing Christ. Now, he does that beginning in verse 17. And so I want us to begin reading there. This is kind of an introduction to the message today. Look down at verse 17. Jesus said, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, unless heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, the two things we need to notice when we read that. One, he talks about all the righteous requirements of the law. And what he's saying is that, listen, I didn't come to abolish those. I mean, I'm teaching this new message, this proclaiming this new hope and new righteousness, but I've come to abolish the law. I've come to fulfill it. And so what he's teaching us is everything that we need in righteousness, Christ has accomplished through his life, death, and resurrection, and he offers it to us. The second thing that's kind of challenging for most people when you think about it, particularly the crowds and the disciples that day, when he said that our righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees in order for us to enter heaven, he really meant to portray an impossible achievement. I mean, just to kind of make the point absolutely clear to each of us, the righteousness that's required to meet and to enjoy a right standing with God, we cannot meet on our own. And what he wants to do is produce in us a despairing of our own righteousness so that we would run to Christ to receive his righteousness. And in fact, when you think about it, we talked about it last week, there's really three ways we could look at this. One, just know that Christ, in one way, isn't just raising the bar. He's not saying that the Pharisee's standard is too low, you just need to pick another standard. He's really raising the bar in this way to an impossible standard. And another way we look at it is he was moving the bar from external observances, just following the law externally, trying to meet this righteousness by external obedience, to a change of the heart internally. And then the last, he was really taking the bar. He's saying, what you could not achieve on your own, this righteousness is impossible for you to achieve on your own. I'll take that and I'll fulfill every righteous requirement of the law, so that you might enjoy a relationship with me and right standing with God. And last week we read a statement by Leon Morris, which is a great theological statement that really helps us understand what he's talking about. And what he said is this: the Christian's righteousness is a given righteousness. Nowhere do we get the idea that the servant of God achieves in his own strength the kind of living that gives him right standing before God. And so he's just firmly establishing the idea that the righteousness required for right standing with God is far above that of the scribes and the Pharisees. It's not just about trying to keep external laws. That's an attempt that will fail miserably every time. The perfect righteousness God requires is fully supplied in the person of his son, Jesus. And when we come to know him, he takes our sin, we take his righteousness, and we have a relationship with God. Now, what's interesting, once he establishes that, is where he takes the sermon from there. He really moves from talking about this new righteousness, a truly righteous life, to talking about unrighteousness. In fact, if you look down in your scripture, you'll see that he starts off with this statement in verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old. And then down in verse 22, he says, but I say to you. Now, he does this, when he starts talking about this righteous life, he really uses six illustrations over the next several verses, all the way through verse 48, to make his point. And when he does it, he introduces every one of those illustrations with the same statement. You have heard it said of old, but I say unto you. Very, very important for us to understand the point that Jesus is making. He's speaking with authority. I mean, the crowds had seen his miracles. They'd seen his amazing works. They've heard him teach. They even said he teaches as one who has authority, not like one of the teachers that we've heard. Now, Jesus is making the point himself. You have heard it said of old, but I say to you. He's letting them know that what he says with authority. I'm telling you the truth. This is the voice of the Messiah that was promised speaking to you. God in the flesh, the anointed one, the Son of God, and declaring to you what is true. It's a powerful thought. Now, what he does is he starts with two very weighty illustrations. Look down in verse 21. He says, you've heard it that was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. Now, you got to think. Remember, when Jesus is talking, there are two groups. There's the disciples, those who knew him and are following him, and then there's the crowd that are gathered on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee listening to Jesus, but they don't know him yet. He's talking specifically to the disciples, but he understands that the crowds are listening. So everyone is listening. And he starts off with this dramatic, powerful illustration. You've heard it said to those of old, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be liable to judgment. I'm assuming that every disciple and most of those in the crowd, almost all those in the crowd, were like, man, that is really good to hear because I have never committed murder. This is a bad illustration, but I've never committed murder. This is a powerful point he's making, a heinous crime. Good news for me, I've never committed murder. But watch what he says. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. And whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. Now he has everybody's attention, doesn't he? I mean, he's been talking about righteousness. And he's been talking about, listen, if your righteousness doesn't exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, and everyone in that crowd, even the disciples, thought, man, the scribes and Pharisees, they know the law. They talk about the law. They hold others accountable to the law. They multiply the law. So what are we talking about? And he says, well, let me just make a point. You've heard it said, you shall not commit murder. But I say to you, you shall not be angry with your brother. Man, everything changed when Jesus moved to that point. He went from almost no one included in this unrighteous act to everyone being included. I know there's sometimes when we talk about things that are going on in this world, and sometimes even addressed in a sermon, you can say, well, he's really preaching to the crowd this day and today, and I hope he really gets them. But when you start talking about getting angry, nobody can dodge that bullet because we've all been affected by it. We've all been tainted by it in some way. And if he hadn't gotten personal enough, if you jump down to verse 27, this is what he says. Second illustration. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. Why are you talking about really getting in people's business and really talking about where people live? I mean, he really is addressing a weighty subject. You shall not commit adultery. Verse 28, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Powerful illustrations of unrighteousness. And he starts off with murder and adultery. I mean, those are very, very weighty, very tough to deal with issues. And if they're not tough enough, he ties murder to anger and ties adultery to lust. He went from talking about externals to talking about internal, to talking about things that just affect a few people to things that affect everybody. You say, why really did he start with those two? I think the two reasons are, one, because they're so common, and two, because they're two of the Ten Commandments. Commandment number 6 and number 7. I mean, he really is making the point. The righteousness required for right standing with God is far greater than you think. And again, I want you to know his base point in all of this, all the way through verse 48, is just to let them know and to help them see that their righteousness, no matter how good it is, even the best of us, will not meet the righteous requirements that God has for us. And so, when you think about it, and you look at these two illustrations, it's very, very interesting the way he lays them out so that we'll not miss his point. I mean, he indeed is a master teacher. He begins with the action, external and obvious. He talks about murder, he talks about adultery. Those are external and obvious. He moves from action to attitude, from external to internal, often what we overlook, isn't it? I mean, if somebody commits murder, we quickly will say they're guilty, right? Guilty of a heinous sin. One of the most despicable things of the human heart is take another life and murder. But if someone says, well, I've been really angry with someone, what do? Just overlook it. No harm, no foul, just an attitude in the heart. It's no big deal. But Jesus ties them together, murder and anger. And then the last thing he does is he reveals the answer. It's immediate and complete. This is what you do in response to this. So let's just look at those two. First, he starts with murder. That's the action. The attitude is anger. The answer, reconciliation. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. The second one is adultery. That's the action. The attitude is lust, and the answer is protection. Now, before we move any further, let me just clarify something. With Jesus tying these together, lust and adultery, anger and murder, he's not saying that these are the same. You say, well, wait a minute. He's saying that lust is a sin. Yes, he is. He's saying that anger is sin. Yes, he is. Well, murder is a sin. Yes, it is. Adultery is a sin. Yes, it is. Well, isn't sin sin? Yes, sin is sin, or it wouldn't be called sin. Y'all with me? But all sin is not the same. And far be it from any of us to take this path, because the heart is deceived and wicked, and who can know it, and just make this obvious statement. It does not mean that if you're angry with him, you go commit murder. It doesn't mean that if you lust after someone that you just go ahead and commit adultery. That's not the connection here. He's just making the point amazingly clear that we all need Jesus. Now let's just take these individually. Let's talk murder and anger, this partnership. Why the harsh start? You go from the Beatitudes to talking about salt and light, a challenging message, talking about the righteousness that God requires, and now we jump right to murder and anger. Well, it really reveals the despicable, desperate state of mankind, doesn't it? And it's all through Scripture. Genesis chapter 4, verse 8, what happened? Cain murdered his brother Abel, right? Now, just if you jump forward a little bit in the Old Testament, to Proverbs chapter 6, this is one of the passages I used to read every single day. And you say, well, this is not a real positive, uplifting passage. No, but it's one that I want to be reminded of because it so clearly outlines what God hates. Listen to what it says. There are 6 things that the Lord hates, 7 that are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and here's murder, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, and feet that make haste to run to evil. And so he's just outlining for us those things that God hates, and one of those on the list is God hates hands that shed innocent blood. God hates murder. Even at the end in Revelation 22, verse 15, it says, outside are the dogs and sorcerers and the sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. What all this adds up to the thing that we already know. Murder is a grievous sin. And what Jesus does is he ties it to anger. Now, I want to, again, state the obvious. Neither Jesus nor the Scriptures say all forms of anger are sinful. We know that in the life of Jesus, in his righteous anger, he cleansed the temple. We also know that in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, that the Apostle Paul says, be angry and yet do not sin, right? That's just very difficult for us to do, isn't it? When you become angry, that you don't sin in your anger. There's no sin that comes out of that. And then in Psalm 7, verse 11, it says that God is angry with the wicked every day. So Jesus is not talking about righteous anger, but he is talking about the common anger that plagues most of us in this life. And it's interesting how he takes it. He says, but I say to you in verse 22, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, that's like the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. He's making the point how serious this is. And he's describing it like one step after another, increasingly in intensity. Like in the first, he's talking about this anger, simmering anger, a grudge. It has to do with a brooding or simmering anger that's nurtured and not allowed to die. It's like a souring of the soul. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15, the writer of Hebrews calls it the root of bitterness. Whether you are actually offended or you just took up an offense against someone else, we've probably all been there, haven't we? We allowed anger to dwell in our heart and we've held on to it. But he moves from there. He moves from just that brooding, grudge-type anger to this malicious contempt. Really, when he uses the word raka, which doesn't have a good English equivalent, it was common in those days, commonly used in those days, but it really means that you're referring to someone as senseless. It's a word of arrogant contempt. And you say, well, that's really not that big a deal. Well, think about it this way. David spoke of this kind of slander in this way, in Psalm 140, verse 3. There are people who sharpen their tongues as a serpent. Poison of a viper is under their lips. That's pretty serious. And if that's not serious enough, in Matthew 27, this kind of word would have been used to describe how Jesus was mocked as they placed the crown of thorns on his head and crucified him. So it's pretty serious. Third thing he does is he takes it one step further, just a condemning accusation of accusing someone to be godless. It's the word moros, M-O-R-O-S, from which we get our word moron. It's akin to the word mara, which means a rebel, godless, someone who's totally senseless but also godless. And what he does with this, he says, listen, you've heard it said, you shall not murder. And whoever murders is going to be liable to judgment. It's easy for us to point fingers at people with that, isn't it? But I say to you, everyone who's angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Now that's weighty. And the reason it's so weighty is because there's not one person in this room that can dodge that. And he goes on to say, here's what you should do. Reconcile. Why? In verse 23, he says, so if you're offering your gift at the altar and remember that there's a brother, that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Obviously, we need forgiveness for allowing anger to be harbored in our heart. What he's telling us first and foremost is our relationships with one another affect our relationship with God. He's painting the picture of coming to worship. And you realize you've got this division. Leave your offering, go reconcile, and then come and worship. Now I understand, and Jesus did too, that it takes two to tango. You can't make somebody forgive you. But you can do everything from your position to forgive, to not hold on to anger, to ask God for forgiveness of the anger in your own heart, and to do your best to reconcile. And that's the call. I mean, if he didn't have everybody's attention by just talking about anger and murder, then he talks about adultery and lust. He moves to this whole idea out of Exodus 20:14. The seventh commandment, that you shall not commit adultery. He's really talking about, and I think we all know what he's talking about. He's talking about if you have sexual relations with someone who's not your spouse, this is a gift to a marriage. And when you step outside of that, it's a struggle, it's a sin. And it's easy to point our fingers. You remember the woman who was brought before Jesus who was caught in what? Adultery? Do you remember the story? What did Jesus say? He who is without sin, cast the first stone. And what happened that day in that encounter? Where did the people go? They all left. You think they had all committed adultery, actually? No. But they knew what Jesus had said. Lust in their own heart. Now, Jesus didn't leave it there. He said, go your way and sin no more. Where are your accusers? Neither did I accuse you. He has the power to forgive. And that's the great news, isn't it? The whole point is he is tying lust to adultery. And he says we're liable to judgment. It's pretty powerful. Now, you got to remember what Jesus is doing here. He's really talking to the crowds and saying that the requirements, the righteous requirements that I ask for are impossible to achieve on your own. But I'll give them to you. I will give you this righteousness if you'll come to me in saving faith. And to those of the disciples, he's saying, listen, the standard is so much higher. Now that you are a part of my family and belong to my family, listen, live as salt in life, so that people may see your good works and give glory to your Father who's in heaven. It's an amazing call. You say, well, what should we do? Look down, if you will, in verse 29. He says, if we have lust in our heart, what do we do? Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you should lose one of your members than your whole body be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. And you say, now that really had everybody's attention. That doesn't sound like Jesus, does it? He was making a point. A very exaggerated statement, but what he was telling us, listen, when sin occupies your life, you should take drastic measures to guard your heart so that you do not sin. And you say, well, do you really mean that you ought to pluck your eye out and cut your right hand off? Well, part of the answer is found in just kind of watching the ministry of Jesus and those disciples. There weren't any one-eyed disciples, were there? Do we have any record of that? There weren't any one-handed disciples. And yet all of them probably been touched in some way, to some degree, by this issue of lust. What Jesus is saying is, guard your heart. Same thing in Proverbs 4:23, same thing throughout Scripture. Guard your heart to his disciples. Sin may not take up residence in you. So here's what I want to do. I'll wrap it up this way. Let's look at what he was saying to the crowds and what he was saying with all of this to the disciples. To the crowds, he was saying, listen, there is a God in heaven. And he does require righteousness. It must be yours to be in right standing with Him. But it is an exercise in futility for you to try to achieve it on your own. Why? Because the standard is higher than that of the Pharisees and the scribes. It's absolute perfection. So the question is, so how do we gain it? If we can't gain it through effort, our own energy, you gain it by coming to me. That's why he said, I have fulfilled the righteous requirements of the law. I didn't do away with them. I fulfilled them. So he becomes our righteousness. But what is he saying to the disciples? They know him. What was the message? The message was, now that you're a part of our family, now that your lives are secure in me, the expectation of righteousness far exceeds external rule keeping. It dives to the weighty matters of the heart, that you ought to live in joyful obedience. It gets kind of like this if you think about it. Let's just say I shared this week with someone, and I was thinking about this, bringing this message together. It's just something I saw happen years and years ago at a game. It wasn't exactly like this, but it just made me think about the way we view God sometimes is so odd. So here's the situation. You're at a baseball game, 9-year-olds. You're sitting in the stands, all the players are warming up. All the little guys out there warming up. You look out on the field and you're like, man, there is one kid that is just far above every other player on the field. Just athlete. Man, what an athlete. You don't know the kid? Don't know really anything about him? You're just watching him warm up. Man, this kid is just so good. It's amazing. After the warm-up, before the game, the kid runs up and you've been watching this guy. He's been sitting right in front of you. His dad, he's just so intense. He's intense and they're just warming up. Okay? It's obvious he has a kid out there somewhere. Well, this kid that was so good runs out the field, runs up in the stands, and looks his dad in the eye, and his dad says, hey, son, listen, you just overhear the conversation. I've been looking at the players. You're by far the best player on this field. Okay, you're better than everybody here. So, today, you got to go 4-for-4. That's every time you come to bat means you got to hit, for those of you who don't know baseball. And you got to hit at least one home run. And you're playing shortstop today? 0 errors. You do that, you come off the field. Why don't you come right here? And I'll tell you, I love you. Now, if you're sitting there and you're hearing that, what are you thinking about that dad? You're thinking that's pretty terrible, right? That kid runs out on the field, strikes out, first time up. What happens? Dad doesn't love me. Hard play in the infield, makes an error. Dad doesn't love me. Now, we would think that'd be terrible parenting. It probably does happen, but terrible parenting. Now, why do we think God acts like that? Why do we think that God treats us like that? But we do. You know what the scripture says? Jesus said this. If your father knows how to give good gifts to his children, will not your Father in heaven give good gifts to you? On the other hand, kids are warming up, you're watching. That kid's the best one on the field. He runs up to talk to his dad. Dad's so intense, but he looks at him and says, hey, son, listen, this is just a game. but you got to play it. But I want you to know one thing. You're my son. Nothing will change that. If you hit the ball every time, get a base hit, a couple home runs, that's great. If you didn't get one hit, you make no errors or make error every time the ball comes to you. I just want you to know this. At the end of the day, I love you and you belong to me. I mean, that's good news, isn't it? What I want you to hear and want you to understand is Jesus said, he made it really clear, that sin, the standard, moves from external to internal. The challenge for us is great. And he really just wants us to realize two things. We need to despair of our own righteousness and run to Jesus for the true righteousness that only comes from him. And then once we know him, we live this day out every day in full assurance that no matter what happens, we are safe and secure in the grip of his grace. We are his children, he is our father, and there's nothing that will change that. So we are to live in joyful obedience to the glory of his name.